Hello and welcome to the World Cricket Show, the world's favourite cricket show. Back on the air this week in spite of needlessly spiteful popular demand. My name is Adam Baithwell and I'll be your host for this. And back alongside me in the flesh is none other than Tony Kerr.
Here we go.
How's it going, Tony?
Tell you what, you were visibly tired. Well, you are visibly tired. You were sort of kind of mopping your brow, kind of looking very weary before, but you've switched it on. You are a true performer.
The guy's a pro.
Yeah, exactly.
What can I say?
You wouldn't know.
I'm very, very tired. I've been up since 5:15 this morning. My son got me up at 5:15 this morning, which is obviously 4:15 old money, Tony, because the clocks have just changed. So, yeah, I am very tired. I was thinking on the way here, I was like, I wonder if I'll hit the wall, but I think I've got off the wall this morning. I think I'm still on the wall.
Sliding down it.
So incredibly tired, so we'll see how this goes. But, you know, as soon as the mics go hot,
the adrenaline
just kind of swings into action. I've got 370 episodes of experience, you know, just flowing through my veins. And it just, I mean, just try to stop me, Tony.
Well, yeah. I mean, to be fair, it has been a little while, hasn't it? I think we overdid it during the Ashes, didn't we? We suffered from post-Ashes burnout, for sure, which we've only just recovered from, to be honest.
Yeah, well, we did Ashes daily, didn't we, throughout that series. So I kind of took the approach that we just have a certain quota of a number of episodes that we have to record per year. And in 2022, we hit it on like January the 9th. So
exactly.
I just thought, take the rest of the year off. So we have been away for a while, but it's good to be back then, isn't it? The boys are back in town. I'm assuming... Just check with the producer here. I'm assuming he's playing that under the... He's got a little bed of Thin Lizzy under this, have you? The boys are back in town. Good to be back.
Isn't it? Bloody hell, is there a lot to talk about?
There certainly is. Yeah, it was sort of combination... I mean, we'll talk about this more at the end, maybe. A combination of post-Ashes burnout.
I think this is what people already come to us for. It's... To be, our explanations of why we weren't able to record more podcasts, that's basically sort of a good 40% of every show.
Virtually every episode starts with a 5-minute weaselly
apology
for why we haven't been doing this.
Well, I mean, you wonder why we do it to ourselves, because, like, you know, almost every email I send out begins with sorry for the slow reply.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we lumber ourselves with this podcast where we have to begin one by sorry for the late podcast.
Apologies for the delayed response. You should see my email inbox, Dane. It's just flag it.
Yeah.
Flag it and move on. More
just
flags
send
than
it.
More flags than the UN, my email inbox. It's absolute disgrace. But one of my flagged emails was from you saying, when shall we do a pod? But I've made a note here of why we've not been doing it. Why we've been away, and it says I've been working.
So, that's a good excuse.
It's a good excuse, isn't it? As good an excuse as any. But anyway,
working hard.
Back now, and loads of cricket to talk about, as you say. What have we got to talk about?
Way too much, I think. Way too much. I mean, it's the World Cricket Show. I mean, expect 90% England chat. And then a couple of brief mentions of what else is going on, and then we're off.
90% England chat, 8% Weasley apology, 2% everything else. And everything else this week includes Australia and Pakistan, pretty big series there. But I think, the focus is going to be England in the Caribbean, because, Tone, England's Red Bull reset is officially underway, and what a success it's been so far. It's officially underway, and it's officially over, really, isn't it? The reset needs to be reset. It's hit the buffers already. A 3-test series in the Caribbean has ended in defeat for England after draws in Antigua and Barbados were followed by a 10-wicket loss in Grenada. I'm not going to go through the full ball-by-ball report on each game. The first two matches were, I mean, as I said, they ended in draws. And then there were moments where it threatened to become good games, but in the end, probably both relatively tame finishes on the final day, weren't they? In Antigua, England made 311 with Johnny Bairstow making a century. West Indies responded with 375 with Nkrumah Bonner making a century. England set up a declaration with Zach Crawley and Joe Root both making hundreds, but West Indies managed to bat out 70 overs on the final day, losing just 4 wickets. So it was a draw there, and it was a similar pattern in game two. England again batting first. They made 507 for 9 declared this time, their biggest score for quite a while. Another 100 for Joe Root a century for Ben Stokes as well, almost a runner ball, 120. That did put West Indies under some pressure, even on a very flat pitch, but Craig Brathwaite, quite astonishing, 160 from 489 balls, and a century also from Jermaine Blackwood. They batted out the best part of 188 overs to make 411. England did manage to put on some quick runs in their second innings, 185 from 40 overs, to give West Indies a bit of a job on the final day. They had to bat out 65 overs, and they did lose five wickets. But Brathwaite, again, 56 not out from 184 balls, steered his side to safety. So a draw in the first game, a draw in the second game, two pretty flat pitches, but it was a much more lively surface in Grenada. And England were skittled out on the first day, weren't they? They were all out for 204, and it could have been a lot worse than that. They were 53 for 6. They were then 114 for 9. But a remarkable last wicket stand between Jack Leach and Saqib Mahmood, who made 49. Got them up to what looked like, if not quite par, at least a defensible score of 204. And they would have been feeling pretty buoyant when they had West Indies 95 for 6. But an astonishing, really, 100 from Joshua De Silva, his maiden test century, 100 not out from 257 balls. Got West Indies to 297. And England, in response, were bowled out again for 120, with Kyle Mayers taking 5 for 18. That's 5 for 18 from 17 overs. And West Indies only had to chase 28 in the fourth innings, and they did that with all 10 wickets to spare to wrap up that 10-wicket victory and give themselves the series. There's quite a lot to talk about here, Tone. This is, it's a 1-0 series win for West Indies, a defeat for England, continuing their long and proud record of only one series win in the Caribbean since 1968. There's still, I mean, again, coming into this series, there's still a feeling that this is quite an easy assignment for England. It's like, oh, the Caribbean, you know, how difficult can that be? We'll talk about this maybe, but, you know, rest and rotate. But yeah, they've won once, which is in 2004. That's the only time they've won since the 60s. They've got, you know, that's a pretty miserable record they've got here. And when you look at the sort of relative resources of the two teams and the quality of the West Indies team over the last 25, 30 years, it's arguably one of their most embarrassing records, you would say. So there's a lot to talk about here, Tony. My first question to you is, I mean, you really have to question why we weren't there, Tone, for these games. I mean, heads have got a roll, surely.
I mean, that's the big fallout from this. Yeah.
Root and branch review needed.
Well, how many days cricket would you have turned up to if you'd gone to all three tests, though, and not just gone straight to the beach?
It's a good question.
I mean, we should have been. Yeah, you know, we've of course watched some cricket in Barbados before, which has been fantastic. And you know, it's a cracking place to watch cricket, and obviously the England fans turn out in their numbers for that. I have to say, Grenada would be pretty high up my list to get to you next time for a test match, because it looked fantastic there, and a strong local crowd, really cool ground. You've been to Grenada, but I don't think you've been to the cricket.
I've not been to the cricket there, but I did go to Grenada in 2018. One of my absolute favourite places in the world, I would say. Love Grenada. And I would say with this whole series, I mean, we'll talk about this, but certainly until the final test, you can make a case that this wasn't the most exciting test series of all time. But I really enjoyed it. But I don't know how much that is because I just love watching cricket in the Caribbean, especially, you know, this time of year. When it's been so cold, it's cold and dark outside, and just to flick that on, and it really kind of warms you up, doesn't it? And the time zone as well.
Just sort of double screening, looking at flight prices.
And an absolutely cracking time zone that you can come
hell
into
of
work
a time
and,
zone for cricket
watch
for
it,
us.
Watch a lot of it. So I've really enjoyed it, and we'll get into why. But I mean, why don't you give us your hot take, Tone? Changes to the England team, but it's ended in familiar fashion. More collapses, another series defeat. What have you made of it all?
Are we mashing the reset button now? Is that what the stage we're at?
Mario Party.
I mean,
style.
To be fair, I think the word reset was pretty strong, wasn't it? You know, given when the squad was named, and then certainly when the team was named for the first test, there was just a sense of, cool, you know, let's watch some cricket, shall we, rather than any sense of like, oh, can't wait to... I mean, okay, yeah, there were some positives. Saqib Mahmood looks the part and you know, is a good addition, albeit didn't play the first test. Arguably the one sort of player in the squad where there was a bit of excitement about and a bit of intrigue, you know, wasn't given the chance to make as much of an impact as they could have done. So elsewhere, it was like, well, you know, we know, okay, Alex Lees, we know about most of these players, and most of these players have been there in this last couple of years where, the last few years where things have drifted and then fallen off a cliff. So, yeah, I don't know. I think the reset was some mumbo jumbo.
Always optimistic. It's an interesting comparison, actually, that with this Red Bull reset compared with the White Bull reset, which I don't know if that's what it was called at the time. But certainly in retrospect, you can describe it as that the White Ball reset that England, the button that they pushed in 2015, because there, you know, they did bring in a whole load of new players and it was like, right, we're going to change approach, change method, change strategy. And they brought in people like Jason Roy, who hadn't played before. And although there were some, there was some continuity of faces, there were guys coming in that you thought, well, this could go horribly wrong, but I'm excited to see what happens, and if it pays off, it'll be great. Whereas this, you know, with this Red Bull reset, you just weren't sitting there thinking, oh, I can't wait to see what Craig Overton can do. You know, it's just not, there wasn't that same feeling of this sort of edge of possibility. That it just is going to take a very long time, this, you know, whether or not they've got the right ideas and the right plans in place at this stage is an open question. But even if they have, it's just not going to be a quick fix, because we're really talking about structural things, and it may take a new generation of players coming through. You know, it might be that it's about part, you know, it's sort of focusing on the next generation rather than this one. It might be too late for this one. That might be overstating it, but it's just that there just aren't players out there. They've tried them all, as we talked about during the Ashes. So anyone who thought that there was going to be a sudden change in fortunes, I think that was very optimistic.
Yeah, it's quite a complicated situation in a way, isn't it? And there isn't an obvious path through this sort of mire for England, because it's not like there is a queue of you know, heavily tipped prospects ready to come on, and it's just that there's a team who have sort of reached the end of their lifespan and are being sort of coax towards retirement, sort of with a sentimental eye, and it's not and you know, the fact obviously that Broad and Anderson weren't taken on this tour, you know, nor have we really picked a team to the sort of with any sense of like, yeah, you know, sort of possibly picking your best side to win the series. It felt like a bit of a halfway house, this squad and this side, and you know, the Wolves are clearly closing in on Joe Root as captain, and it's a bit sad because he's such a likable player, seems like a great guy. You know, doesn't seem like he's maybe getting the best advice, or he's not been given the tools to do what is such a prestigious job to the best of, you know, the best of his ability. And just when some of those wickets are falling in the second innings in Grenada, you know, the expressions on his face, it was tough to watch, actually. It was like, it was pretty, you just felt for him. I don't know. He just looked kind of, short, you know, like run out of ideas and sort of run out of belief about what he was witnessing, really. So, you know, all in all, it hasn't really moved England on in any meaningful direction, has it? And yeah, we'll talk about the summer in a bit, but you know, presumably at this point, we're going to have to, they will bring Anderson and Broad back in the summer. But we haven't really, on the bowling side of things, clearly that's not, as we've said in, you know, ad nauseum after the Ashes, that's not where the issues are, but that will be still a massive focus. And clearly England not winning test matches in this series will mean that there'll be a massive clamour for those two to come in. And you know, there's all kinds of chat about the dressing room harmony and you know, the influence some senior players have been having. And I don't know, you get the feeling that this isn't, well, as you say, it's a long-term process, but you get the feeling that there's going to be no sense of progress until at least the end of the year or at the end of the summer, because you know, if England don't want Anderson and Broad or don't see Anderson and Broad as being part of the Red Bull reset, they're still going to have to give them they will have to give them a sentimental run out in the summer to see them off.
Well, not necessarily. So,
well, I have to. Because, what you know, are people going to turn out? I mean, they will turn out in good numbers, I'm sure. But are they going to turn out in their droves? You know, what's the story if England tank this summer and Anderson and Broad don't play and we never see them again? If you were the ECB ticket sellers, you'd be saying, just bloody hell, get them in there, because that will be something to build the summer around.
There will
be sort of the farewell tour.
There will certainly be a huge amount of pressure if they don't pick them against New Zealand and they get battered. It will be very tough to withstand that pressure. And obviously the fact that, you know, it's seemingly Strauss who's made this decision or has kind of facilitated this decision, and he's only in temporary charge. So whoever comes in may well think, no, we need them back. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if they do play, but I also don't think it's guaranteed. I mean, there's a lot to pick up on from what you said, Tony. I do really want to talk about Root, but we could just talk about Broad and Anderson. I mean, that decision obviously dominated the discussion coming into the series, and the fact that they'd been left out. And I was a bit conflicted about it, and I still am to an extent. I mean, obviously you'd have to say it's not paid off, at least in the immediate term, because they've lost the series. And I was certainly surprised by that decision. And it is a curious one because, you know, obviously, as we've talked about ad nauseum, the huge problem for England is the batting. And you'd still say that's the case, that was the case in this series, or that's what lost in the series, wasn't it? Was the fact that the batting imploded again, twice in Grenada. So for the kind of the kind of key headline decision, step one of your reset to be to drop your two best bowlers, that just seems a slightly puzzling strategy. But on the other hand, I don't think either of them are quite the bowlers they were. I think certainly Broad, you can look at and say, well, he hasn't done that much in the last 12 months. I mean, he's, you know, not necessarily, like, he's not as ancient as Anderson, is he? So you could say that's just a dip in form, and he could well come back from that. But, and not that these two things are exactly analogous, but, you know, think about, I did think about the decision to drop Hoggard and Harmison in 2008 and replace them with Anderson and Broad. I mean, that's when Anderson and Broad came in and began their partnership. And dropping Hoggard and Harmison at that moment was a relatively similar decision. They were the two of the kind of 2005 Ashes heroes, and they were the two leaders of England's attack at that point. But neither of them had been performing that well for a little while, and they were dropped in favour of Anderson and Broad, who were younger and, you know, seen as being the future. And at the time, I was apoplectically angry about that decision, but in hindsight, it was clearly the right one. Now, it's not exactly the same situation because there isn't an equivalent of Anderson and Broad, you know, young tyros that were waiting to come in. But it could be that now is the right moment to move them on, because, yeah, as you say, there'll be huge pressure on them to come back in the summer, and I imagine they probably will. But are all these people who are really angry and calling for them to be reinstated, if they are reinstated, will they just kind of smack their hands together and go, right, well, there we go, all sorted, English cricket is back on its feet? Because, like, obviously, at some point, and in the near future, certainly as far as Anderson's concerned, we're talking 1 to 2 years' time, he is going to be gone. So you can say, well, therefore, let's wring the best out of him and let's make sure that England, you know, he's there to help the transition, and let's utilize all his experience and knowledge while we can, and pick your best team as long as you can. But if they bring them back, that is not a long-term fix to this problem, is it?
Yeah, well, no, I agree. I suppose my thinking is just that they will be brought back. So whether whether there has been a disrupted, unharmonious dressing room of late, and whether they've played a role in it, to me, I don't know. I just think it will happen. Mm. So in terms of any reset, you're just putting off the reset, really, for the time being.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, obviously that's one kind of, you know, that was one of the big decisions. Around that, yeah, I don't think we've necessarily moved forward a long way on any of the others. So,
well, Henri, I mean, you've kind of answered this question to some extent, but what do you? I mean, can he carry on after this?
Well, he says he wants to, doesn't he? He says he's got the backing of the dressing room.
But
and that,
should it be his decision?
Well, no, it's one of those things. You know, you don't want to. You know, clearly, as I said before, it's a prestigious role, and you don't want to sack someone, effectively someone who is England's best player, but you know, I don't know. I think he's run out. He's running out of road rapidly if he hasn't already. So, yeah, he's clearly got a massive role to play with the bat for England for years to come, several years to come. So, you know, I'm sure, I'm sure that conversation wouldn't be easy. But you know, someone's going to have to take the tough decisions.
Yeah,
because it doesn't feel necessarily rudderless, but it feels like uninspiring at the moment, isn't it? Some people have been were you know more vocal about some of the fielding arrangements and the passages of play which really drifted in this series and weren't necessarily great reflection on Root's captaincy. It does just feel like he's not even thrashing around. It's kind of it's all happening around him and going wrong. And he's not really able to influence it.
Well, I think rudderless is a good word certainly for what happened on that third morning in Grenada when West Indies, their last two wickets, put on all those runs and built that lead, which ultimately was decisive, wasn't it? And he just wasn't able to affect the game at all. And that's the job of a captain. And the field placings were terrible and he just let the game drift. And it was a feature throughout the series, even in those first two games that were drawn. And you'd say England possibly had slightly the better of those two games, although we'll come on to this, but that's a narrative that's been a little bit overstated. But even within that, he was making some poor decisions. They definitely declared too late in Barbados, and with a little bit more time could have possibly got closer to the win. And something that really annoyed me, and I think I texted you about it at the time, but was on day five in Antigua when it was clearly going to be a draw, Ben Stokes bowled a really long spell where he was just charging and banging it into the pitch and getting nothing out of it. And it's just like, what are you doing? That's such a strange decision to do that when he should be looking after the premier all rounder. So I thought it was a pretty dismal display really from Root as captain throughout the series. And what I think about this, Tone, but he just isn't a good cricket captain. And he's had a fair old crack at it now. He's the longest serving England captain ever, isn't he? In terms of matches, and just hasn't really improved, I don't think. And it would be if England had experienced this run of results, which is what they've won. Is it one of their last 17 tests now, and lost their last four series, possibly five series if you count the India series, which is still semi ongoing. If they just experienced that run of results, but before that, Root had been this kind of all-conquering captain, you'd say, well, he's got a lot of credit in the bank. But people will point to certain results that he's had. But in terms of his record, his own personal record and ability as captain that he's shown, it's just not there. So, as I've said before, I don't see what the benefit of Joe Root being captain is for either him or England. And he might want to carry on, but I don't think it should be his decision.
Yeah, and it might be optimistic thinking, but as we said before, there isn't an obvious sort of cavalcade of talent to bring into the side to remedy the batting failures and the perhaps at times lack of sort of wicket taking options. But so you know, you can't really make a change there, but clearly a change needs to be made. And so the change that you can make is to the captaincy. And as I say, maybe it's optimistic thinking, but under a different captain who's making different decisions, there's a different momentum on the field, and you carry that into your innings, and things happen slightly differently, and the effect kind of butterflies out from there. So yes, in essence, I think definitely the captaincy needs to change, and you would imagine it's not going to make Joe Root a worse batsman if he's not the captain. We saw it again. Clearly he is England's most talented batsman, and his best. He's as enjoyable as anyone to watch in the world. But he scored some runs on a desperately flat and lifeless pitch, lifeless pitches at the start of this series, and then didn't score runs when it mattered. Didn't score runs when it mattered in the Ashes, and yet he scores a century, or he gets his centuries earlier in the a few weeks ago, and the tweets are going out. we're witnessing greatness and all this stuff, and it's like, well, yes, we are. In this man's career, witnessing one of England's all-time best, but over the last few years, he hasn't been producing at the moments that matter. And maybe that's because of the captaincy, because because of the fact that in the big moments where he's having to really think about what's going on and obviously not producing the results.
Think about something more than his batting.
Then the batting, he's not elevating himself as high as he can go. So I think there has to be a change. Clearly, your next question is, who would you
make
captain? But
I almost don't think it matters in the sense that, like, I do think it matters who's captain of England, but I don't think it should matter to this decision. Because, I think if you really just break it down and you say, let's look at the constituent parts of this England team, what are the strengths? The biggest strength is Joe Root's batting. Is Joe Root's captaincy one of the strengths? No. So why? It's one of the weaknesses. So why is he still the captain? Just let him focus and let's make the most of that incredible asset, which is his batting. Let him concentrate on that and find someone else to be the captain. I mean, I never thought I'd say this, but I don't think it's even that absurd to think, let's give it to Alex Leeds, who obviously is a county captain. He scored a couple of 30s in this series.
He looks great.
And he's nailed down a place. But, like, if that doesn't work out because he doesn't score runs this summer, okay, fine. We don't necessarily have to appoint a captain for the next 4 years, but it's got to be someone else. It shouldn't be Ben Stokes.
It probably will be Ben Stokes,
which would be a bonkers decision. But it just needs to be someone other than Root, essentially. Mm. The other thing, we will leave Root, but the other thing that really wound me up was his post-match interview, which I've just seen this exact same interview so many times over the last couple of years. But where he said, and I texted it to you, but he said, it's frustrating because it's frustrating to have lost after playing so much brilliant cricket. And Triscothick said this as well. He's obviously batting coach at the moment, that, like, oh, it's such a shame when we had those two brilliant matches in Antigua and Barbados. And it's like, well, yeah, they played reasonably well. They did score some, right? You got to credit that. And they got 500, but they were two of the flattest pitches you ever see. And they didn't really get that close to actually winning those games, did they? So you can say, like, yeah, it was better.
Statistically, some players enjoyed themselves, but about it.
The idea that they played brilliant cricket there, like, if they're not winning, that is just delusional, unfortunately. And again, as soon as the ball started moving, they fell apart. And so if Joe really thinks that this is just, it's a bit unlucky because they played brilliant cricket, like, yeah, that's another reason why he's got to go, because they need someone in who actually knows what they're talking about. Let's leave Root.
He'll be relieved.
We'll come on to West Indies in a second. The only one other thing I was just going to mention, something that's been a bit of a shame for me, is that Ben Foulkes hasn't really grabbed his chance, has he? He had a couple of opportunities. He kind of got a couple of starts, but averaged a bit less than 20 across the series in the end, and obviously was run out in the sort of crucial innings on that crucial third day in Grenada, which kind of summed up, captured the moment, captured the collapse, really. I mean, he was still a joy to watch behind the stumps for me. I mean, he did drop a couple of catches, and there was one in particular that, you know, didn't look great. But generally, his wicketkeeping is magnificent to watch, and he was standing up to Chris Wokes at times, which is slightly depressing in a way, because it does reflect the fact that Chris Wokes isn't very quick on those pitches. But you can only admire the skill of Foulkes to be able to do that. But yeah, overall, you'd say he's not had a great series, and he seemed, particularly because some of the other, although it's England's batting has failed again, has let them down again, you actually look at the individuals and say, well, okay, Lawrence did okay, didn't he? And Bairstow got that 100, and Stokes got 100, and Alex Lees has somehow emerged with credit. So actually, who's to blame here with the bat? And Foulkes is one of the ones, isn't he? But it's hard to argue that he's had a good series. But for me, if he is discarded now, that will annoy me, because if you look at how many chances, what will probably happen now is that Jos Buttler will come back in for the start of the summer. And let's give him a bit longer for me.
Yeah, we're basically going to end up this summer with probably the team that England were picking in, like, 20, you know, when we came out of the pandemic, won't it? It'll be, Bairstow, Buttler, Root captain, Burns will be back at the top of the order. there aren't, as we say, there aren't
boodles of options. I'd agree with
around.
That.
But no, I agree about folks. It is a shame because he has been. You know, it's the cliche, isn't it? Of the players when you're not playing, you get better. But he's been when he has played for England in over those last few years. He's set the fire to people's imagination somewhat. So yeah, a bit of a shame, but he does deserve a longer run.
Yeah. Anything else to say on England? There have been some positives, haven't there? As I say, Johnny Bairstow batted really well in Antigua. That was good to see. I've always rated him, as you know, Tone. After that 100 in Australia as well, it is good to see him back at his best. And if he truly is back to his best in Test cricket, then that is a huge boost for England. Does make a massive difference to the middle order. Remains to be seen if he can carry that on, but that is encouraging. And I have been impressed by Dan Lawrence. Obviously, didn't have a good test in Grenada. And so there is a question about, when the ball moves a bit, has he got the technique? But he was lovely to watch at times, wasn't he? Quite incredible that he couldn't get a game in the Ashes when you look back at what happened, that he just was carrying the drinks the entire time. Mm. Strange. And I thought Jack Leach bowled well. I thought he bowled reasonably well.
He bowled a lot.
He did bowl a huge amount and he didn't kind of tear it up, did he? But he
did a job.
Stuck
he did
in
his
there.
Job.
Yeah, he did his job, exactly. And that was good. For me, that was good to see after, that he had not such a great Ashes series and the treatment he received from some quarters of the media as well after the Ashes, which I thought was unfair. So I was pleased to see that. So, yeah, overall poor. some positives, but overall poor. Long way to go on this reset. What about West Indies, time? What a result for them. Great scenes at the winning moment. Do you see the video that was obviously filmed on a phone from behind the team in the dressing room at the winning moment? That was nice to watch.
Yeah, some fantastic stuff from the West Indies, really. And we've said on the pod before, we've got a massive soft spot for West Indian cricket, and certainly there are encouraging signs at the moment for sure. And there are lots of good, strong characters emerging, or to build on, the players that have, that really established themselves in recent years. But yeah, some brilliant moments. Josh De Silva getting to his century, with Jaden Seals kind of running through at the other end, was a fantastic,
yeah, their best
a fantastic
mates,
moment, yeah,
Bezzy mates,
awesome to see, and that was a phenomenal innings, probably helped by some generous cricket from England, but hey, you can't take too much away from him for that.
Yeah, it was a real triumph of concentration, that wasn't it, and he actually all the way through the series he batted like that, didn't he? He looked so kind of organised and solid technically. So yeah, he's a huge. A huge prospect for West Indies.
Absolutely. And then, yeah, I suppose through to the end, there were some people being quite sniffy about Carl Mayer's running through England. But, he bustles in and he gets, he made something happen. I don't think you should take too much away from him. Certainly worse bowlers have run through teams before. Mm. And, what a few moments he's collected already in his kind of relatively short career.
Yeah. I mean, it was unexpected, wasn't it? Because he's not in there as one of the sort of key frontline bowlers, and the fact that he was kind of throwing the balls at such an early stage ahead of Jason Holder and ahead of Alzari Joseph, that seems surprising. But as you say, he's no mug, is he? And I suppose the disappointing thing for England is just that given the pace he was bowling at, we talked through the Ashes about the quality of that Australian attack and how for some of these English guys, these English batsmen coming into Test cricket, they've just not experienced anything like that in the County Championship. And, it's just that the Championship bears no relation to the kind of cricket they're faced with, the kind of bowling they're faced with in Test cricket. But actually, Carl Mayer's is exactly the kind of bowling that they're faced with in the County Championship. Good, very effective. But it's the kind of thing that they've seen a huge amount of in their career. So the fact that it's him that kind of unpicked them twice was a disappointing element of that display. But yeah, as you say, what a career he's having so far, and it's surprising that he didn't get a game earlier in the series. Real standout individual performances in all three games, really. Phenomenal batting from Craig Brathwaite in Barbados. Amazing kind of exhibition of concentration and patience. He faced 627 balls across the Test match, which is the most ever by a West Indian. And that, was it 160 in the first innings, was one of the longest innings ever by a West Indian. The third longest by a West Indian against England. He was on the field almost the entirety of that test. I think he missed 19 overs of the first innings and otherwise was on the pitch, on the field of play for the whole of the 5 days. That was pretty amazing. And Nkrumah Bonner obviously was the hero in Antigua as well. And, you know, he's been a great addition to this team. And same with as we mentioned, with De Silva and Mayers. And it's interesting because when West Indies beat England in the Caribbean 3 years ago and we were there, Tone, you know, at that moment you thought, this is so exciting. There are so many kind of exciting prospects in this team. But actually some of those have kind of fallen by the wayside, seemingly, like Shimron Hetmyer and Shea Hope. Whereas a lot of the key players in this series are people that weren't there 3 years ago, like De Silva and Mayers and Bonner and Jaden Seals. So I don't know whether that's entirely a good thing because, yeah, some of the Shimron Hetmyer at that point, we thought, well, he's going to clearly be a rock solid feature of this middle order and isn't. So it remains to be seen. But it's exciting for West Indies that they seem to have so many options. I hadn't clocked, Tone, that Desmond Haynes is now the chief selector of West Indies. He was, when we spoke to him in Barbados 3 years ago, is it fair to say he was angling for that? He definitely seemed keen on the idea.
It was a good sales pitch on the pod.
But he seems to have made a few changes. And one thing that I noticed was that, and I don't know whether this is like a deliberate strategy of his or it's just the way it's worked out, but it seems like there are more islands represented than there were. So 3 years ago, this was a noticeable feature that I think 10 or certainly 9 of the first choice 11 were all from Barbados. Whereas now, certainly in the first two games, there were still 4 from Barbados, but 3 from Jamaica, 2 from Trinidad, 1 from Guyana and 1 from Antigua. So it's just a bit more of an even spread. And as I said, I don't know whether that's deliberate, but it did feel weirdly lopsided before. And you wondered whether there was some politicking involved in that, whereas this feels a bit more equitable, doesn't it? And it seems to make sense to try, you know, to spread or to be sort of reaching out as widely as possible across the region. So anyway, there's clearly lots of potential there. Still some way to go, I think it's fair to say. And, you know, as we talked about, England are not very good. And West Indies results in the 3 years since they last beat England haven't always been that amazing. So let's not get carried away. But I think there are substantially more reasons to be optimistic than a few years ago. And one thing that I really thought was striking here was that they do seem to be harder to beat than they used to be. So, yeah, very, very flat pitches in Antigua and Barbados. But the fact that West Indies didn't fold in a heap under the pressure on the final day on either occasion, you wonder whether they may well have done that in the past, but they did hold firm, and that's, yeah, encouraging signs.
Yeah, there does seem to be some real resolve there, and yeah, certainly by the end of the series, they were bang up for it, weren't they? When they were running through, Jason Holder took an unbelievable catch at leg slip.
That was an incredible catch. The camera almost couldn't follow.
Yeah, genuinely almost missed it, or pretty much does miss it. I mean, he didn't have a classic series with battle ball, but, you know, he was in the mix and he was influencing big moments for sure. But it is an encouraging time for sure. And, you know, you look at that bowling attack or the players certainly that turned out in this series. Kumar Roach is just a phenomenal player, isn't he? And, you know, is obviously given an awful lot to West Indian cricket and still, you know, looks as good as ever.
How old is he? I feel like
he's been around for ages. Yeah.
He's only 33. Considerably younger than you, Tay.
And Jaden Seals as well looks a real prospect. So yeah, good stuff. Good to see.
Is exciting.
Wouldn't have wanted to lose to a nicer team.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is exciting, and I get very excited about this. But we will see, you know, they're going to face much, much tougher assignments than that. And you would imagine that, the likes of New Zealand or Australia or India coming to the Caribbean at this point would, you know, that would be very much more difficult for the West Indies. So, yeah, there's a long way to go. But, yeah, you can't help but be pleased with them. And at least in my case, you can't help but start to get a little bit excited about the idea that they do just seem to have, they're not relying on one or two players here. They do seem to have much more depth than they used to.
As you say, England, you know, given the circumstances that English cricket finds itself in, certainly on the test side, a nice series for West Indies to have there. England sort of slipping down the rankings, West Indies in eighth in the test rankings, England down to fifth. You'd think West Indies would be targeting, overtaking them at some point in the not too distant future.
Mm. And England rock bottom of the World Test Championship as well, aren't they? Which luckily nobody cares about. We've touched on this a bit, but probably the biggest talking point from the first two tests was the pitches, which were both pretty turgid, I think it's fair to say. I don't know if you had any kind of burning thoughts about the pitches, Tony. I mean, this feels like given what happened in Grenada, this feels like slightly out of date discussion in a way, but it was the thing that most people were focused on because, you could argue that they were relatively boring draws, both of those. I mean, I'm slightly in two minds about it because on the one hand, I did think that there was a bit of an overreaction to the pitches in some quarters because I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with a test match that goes 5 days and ends in a draw. Like that seems like an acceptable thing to happen in test cricket from time to time. Two and over is okay sometimes. I don't think test cricket has to be played at a kind of breakneck pace to be sort of absorbing and interesting and even exciting. Clearly those pitches weren't conducive to great cricket, were they? And, when on the last day the seamers are kind of banging it in halfway down the pitch and it's getting up sort of knee height and just being met by a straight bat, that's a bit dispiriting, I suppose. And it's a shame because a couple of years ago, and we saw in Grenada this time, but certainly 3 years ago when England last toured, it did seem like, the pitches in the Caribbean seem to be a bit better now, a bit livelier, because, 10 years ago, certainly it was, the Caribbean was just about the flattest place in the world, wasn't it, for test cricket? And it seemed like things were getting better. So hopefully these two pitches were just a bit of an aberration, but something to watch, because if you want to find a way to kill off test cricket anywhere, but especially in the Caribbean, that seems to be the way to do it.
Yeah, it's quite hard, isn't it, to gauge just purely based on how long the match lasts. It's an incredible, basically, as we said before, cricket fans are looking for
everything,
every test match to fall within about a 45 minute window, session three of day five. Would you prefer a test match to go to 5 days? This is the thing, wasn't it, that the results, they were never really in danger in the end on those 5 days, but probably better to go to 5 days than be over in two and a half and neither team be able to lay bat on ball. So I don't know. Yeah, it is difficult, but I agree, it didn't make necessarily for great spectating.
Well, that may be the explanation for it, in that the Cricket West Indies or those individual cricket boards or whatever may have looked at the two batting lineups and thought, we have to make this pretty flat, lads, because otherwise it's going to be over in 2 days. But yeah, it was a little bit disappointing, but let's not overstate it, because even in Barbados it did briefly come to life on the final day, and England could have forced a result there. So I don't think it's the end of the world, but just something to something for them to keep an eye on. Any concluding thoughts on this test series, Tom? We've had your hot take. You've cooled down a bit. What do you reckon?
It does feel like are we at the end of the beginning of the kind of the overhaul of English cricket? We're certainly not anywhere near the end. You know, there's a long way to go before we can have, I think we can look forward to, with some certainty, to good times for English test cricket by the sounds of it. you know, we're heading into a summer with the 100 coming back bigger and better, presumably, or not necessarily bigger, but possibly better. There's talk now
or
of you know, there's talk obviously of Red Bull cricket being restructured. There's a lot of there's divisive chat in English cricket at the moment. So I don't know. We could do with a bit of a fillip, certainly from our test summer. So I don't know. I'm not massively going in hopeful though.
Yeah, well, we talked about this during the Ashes a lot, but the one good thing, the one reason to be cheerful as far as I'm concerned, is that it's been so bad that people do now, apart from Joe Root apparently, people do now seem to understand the scale of the problem. And so, yeah, it's not going to be easy, straightforward or quick, but you feel like change has to happen, change will happen now because people recognise that it's broken. That's not particular. It's not a particularly cheering thought, and it, as I say, it's not going to be. It's not going to be immediate by any means. But the end of the beginning is perhaps, as you say. Well, perhaps as I might cut out what you said and say.
yeah, just return
describe
to
this to myself. I describe it as the end of the beginning of the reset tone.
Yeah.
Right, Tony, well, should we have a quick chat about the test series in Pakistan between the home side and Australia? I don't know how much of this you saw. I'm going to hold my hands up to the listeners and say I didn't see anywhere near as much of this as I had hoped. I've seen YouTube highlights. I'll just look at my notes here. It says I was working. So that's my excuse, Tony. I don't know what yours is.
I saw all of it, mate.
So every ball. Well, yeah, so let's not pretend that we've seen all of this, Tone. And we'll probably just have to talk about this fairly briefly, which is a bit of a shame because it's a noteworthy thing that this series happened at all. And I think it's great that it happened. It's what, Australia's first test series in Pakistan since 1998, I believe that's correct. Is that correct? You can look that up. It's good to have a kind of fact checker on staff
live.
Here, live fact checking. Not many teams have been to Pakistan at all since 2009, so it's good to see that test cricket is back in Pakistan and to have a big kind of landmark marquee series like this is just a good thing. Similar, really, kind of similar pattern to England's series in the Caribbean, and the first two tests both ended in draws. The first one was a real kind of bore draw in Rawalpindi. The second one in Karachi, an astonishing escape from Pakistan, who, after Australia made 5-5-6, declared were bowled out for 148, but managed to bat out in the fourth innings for 171 overs, with Babar Azam 196 from 425 balls. A truly historic innings, and they escaped with a draw with three wickets to spare. But Australia did manage to pull off the victory in the final test by 115 runs to win the series 1-0, which is a pretty incredible result, really, isn't it? We talked in the Ashes about how it was hard to kind of gauge where Australia are at because of how bad England were, but they have three series coming up this year in the subcontinent. This is the first of them, and that's the real kind of litmus test. And they have passed this one with flying colours. They've emerged with a win and with some key contributions from the likes of Usman Khawaja. He made runs throughout the series. Cameron Green with 79 in the final test in Lahore. So, you know, these guys who we felt could be key components have been. And yeah, for Australia, it's a historic result, really. You've been fact-checking that 1998 thing for about 15 minutes. Just been staring at your laptop.
Yeah. I mean, Khawaja's impact since he came back in that Ashes series has been nothing short of remarkable, has it? Was it five tests since he came back in Sydney? Four centuries and two 90s. I mean, Australia would have romped a victory without him, no doubt, in the Ashes, but... but yeah, clearly, you know, had that stunning test in Sydney, two centuries, and then two big innings in this one as well in this series. So yeah, clearly he, as we talked about him, you know, before during that Ashes series, he'd been away for a little while, but there was definitely a sense in some of the higher echelons of Australian cricket that, or amongst some of the legends, that he was he's a player that should be, you know, among the first on the team sheet. Yeah, good for him. What a special series that's been for him.
Yeah, it was 1998. Only took me about 20 seconds to look that
up. Good, aren't you?
So Australia's next test series is in Sri Lanka at the end of June. And then they go to India at the end of the year, don't they? I mean, you'd imagine, given they've won in Pakistan, you'd imagine they're going to be pretty heavy favourites to win in Sri Lanka. The India assignment, much, much tougher. But, you know, that is something to be excited about, isn't it?
Yeah. Definitely a series to anticipate there for sure. Yeah, there's been, I mean, loads of cricket going on, hasn't it, at the moment? And, you know, all eyes now firmly on the Women's World Cup as it reaches the business end. I think certainly from an English perspective, you know, losing the first three games, you got the sense that things might drift a little, but there's an opportunity now with England reaching the semi-finals that there's going to be a big finish. And, you know, hopefully that gets a lot of exposure. Be watching that one with interest, and I think we'll have a few more reflections on that in the next episode, whenever that is.
in October. Amazing that England managed to qualify from that group. They did seem to be gone, seemed to be done and dusted for them, really, didn't it?
It's been a remarkably exciting tournament. Lots of very, very close finishes. I guess the only thing is Australia just look, you know, far too good.
Although Elise Perry ruled out of the semi-final, which starts in an hour and 35 minutes as we're recording this.
So by the time anyone's listening to this, Australia probably knocked out in a massive shock. But, you know, from what we saw in the Women's Ashes, you know, Australia are just there are two moves ahead, aren't they, really, at the moment. So difficult to look past them winning the whole thing. But, yeah, great to see England in the semis.
The final on Sunday, this coming Sunday. We're going to wrap this up in a second, Tane, but before we do, I think we should say something about Shane Warne. We've not done an episode since the tragic news about his death on the 4th of March at the age of 52, which obviously is, you know, has been, well, it was headline news all around the world, wasn't it? And was just incredibly shocking. And upsetting. I couldn't stop thinking about it for ages. I don't know about you, Tane, but it really did affect me quite a lot. Because I think you said it's like somebody who kind of looms that large in your childhood. It's just didn't compute, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I think, trying to think how it made me feel. It was very confronting in the sense that, yeah, as you say, this is someone who's been literally, you know, a central figure in this sport that we've both enjoyed for most of our lives, from the word go for us, effectively, continued in retirement and as a coach and as a pundit. It was only, I think I was only listening to him on the Sky cricket pod 2 or 3 days before he died, and, you know, talking about how much he was looking forward to getting stuck into the 100 this summer, having been sort of unable to make too much of an impact last year because of COVID, missing a few of the matches. So, yeah, it was, you know, when you hear someone, it's funny, is that, yeah, you know, you're listening to someone speaking for half an hour, 45 minutes, whatever it was, on that podcast just a few days before, and then, yeah, then the news came through. It was, yeah, unbelievably shocking. And obviously, yeah, it's no age. And someone, yeah, who clearly still had a lot to give the sport and life as well. So, yeah, really tough one to take.
Yeah, I really have struggled to get my head around it. And we talked about this when Bob Willis died, who's obviously, you know, older than that, but it's still, and had been ill for a long time, but we didn't know that. And it still kind of, for me, came out of the blue. And I haven't really been able to articulate this, but there's something about cricket death, you know, deaths of kind of cricketing people, that it does hit me really hard. And I think it's just something about the way they're so kind of like woven into the fabric of my life. And it's something that's so kind of personal, but you also just take it for granted. They're just like part of the backdrop of life. in a way that other kind of celebrities or even other people in, you know, famous people in other fields that I love and feel a connection to. There's just something about cricket that it just, it's upsetting, but it also, I just can't believe it when it happens. I just really struggle to believe that it was true about Warne. So yeah, very, very upsetting. And it's obviously made people think about, you know, his legacy as a cricketer as well. And like I think he was a very good pundit. I know he did wind me up.
We joked, we're laying into him during the Ashes for kind of constantly chatting.
Yeah.
You know, they barely sort of take a breath, but you know, that maybe wasn't his forte in terms of the sort of punditry game, but certainly when, you know, there were moments where, yeah, clearly his obviously his expertise, his experience, and his kind of original thinking were he was able to get across in an amazing way.
Yeah, because he could certainly be irritating, and I'm sure you could probably find a clip of me kind of laying into him. But I did enjoy his punditry because, you see, I think he had an insight, a real insight into the game. But he's divisive as a pundit, but not as a player. I mean, I think like it has made people think, if the first thing you thought about when you thought about Warne was his commentary or his punditry and the memory of him as a player had started to fade a bit, this happening has brought that much more back into focus. And, you know, it's easy to overstate a case like this when something like this has just happened. But for me, he might be the greatest cricketer of all time, or he's right up there in the conversation, because he's certainly, I think, the only cricketer of our lifetimes who has a claim. Bradman has a strong case, doesn't he? But I would put Warne forward for a couple of reasons. I think he's the most, I don't know if this is the right word, but I think he's the most peerless player that I've ever watched. Like, well, actually, I mean, there's another extraordinary cricketer in Murali who runs him closer than aughts of impossible. And Adam Gilchrist, you could possibly describe in this way. But the thing with Warne is he's essentially the player who you would most definitively want in your team. Like, if you were picking an all-time or a post-Atherton 11, you know, if you wanted Lara or Tendulkar, but you couldn't have them because someone else has picked them, you'd go, okay, well, that's a shame, but that's fine because I'll pick Ponting or I'll pick Dravid or Sangakkara or Kallis or whatever. But with Warne, like in that role in the team, Warne's the one you want, isn't he? And it, you know, Murali is not a bad second choice, but yeah, for me it's like, okay, well, Warne is first name on the team sheet in a sense, isn't he? And the other reason is because of the way he changed the game. Like, very few players ever have kind of individually changed cricket, and changed in particular the way that children play cricket in the way that Warne did. You know, when he came along, suddenly everyone wanted to be a leg spinner. And the it's a cliche, or it's something that you don't even really think about, that when you're playing cricket on the beach, you just go bowling Shane.
Mm.
And that's, you know, what a legacy, really. It's kind of, it sounds kind of trivial in a way, but it's an amazing legacy.
Yeah. I mean, well, he defines leg spin, doesn't he? He is the definitive leg spinner. And as you say, in that sense, peerless, because and irreplaceable. If you picked that World 11 and he got injured, yeah, he wouldn't.
Exactly.
You know, where would you go? Where would you turn next? Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know, clearly, as we were sort of getting into cricket, you know, he'd burst onto the scene and was establishing himself as a, you know, as a top level talent. I think for us as well, I don't know, maybe we almost took him for granted, or certainly I did, took him for granted in terms of his you know, the way he carried himself and just his kind of sort of rock and roll spirits. It's a complete cliche, but it's easy to forget that, you know, to a certain extent didn't exist before, before we got into the game. So as you say, it seems sort of natural that that's a part of cricket. Whereas, yeah, clearly it wasn't before he came along.
And he was so kind of authentically himself. And that wasn't without its problems. But I do kind of admire the way that he just continued to be himself and to express himself in the way he wanted to. And I've been watching a lot of YouTube compilations of his sort of best moments, his best bowling, and it's artistry, isn't it? It's like watching Federer play tennis at his best or something like that. It's glorious to watch. So, and yeah, he seemed like a nice guy too. So it's very, very, very sad. Such a shame.
Yeah, it's funny in a way as well. It's just when I think of Warne as well, so I do sort of think of Peterson, Sloggium. Yeah. And obviously that came at the time when England were, you know, were just on the cusp of doing something they hadn't done, or, you know, being what they hadn't been for so long. Why it was so special is because Warne had been such a tormentor for so long. And it was like, you know, that it sort of underlined, it was like kind of toppling a giant to get to that stage.
Yeah, so, it was like jaw-dropping. Like, you can't do that to Shane. Who does that to Shane Warne?
Yeah.
And one of the remarkable things about him is how he almost continued getting better. And at the age of 39 in the 2005 Ashes, took 40-plus wickets. And I think, I haven't got this stat in front of me, so I'm kind of pulling it out of thin air, but it's something like Warne and McGrath together, Australia didn't lose any of the last 25 or so tests that they played together. They just, both of them just continued to operate right at their best level until the end of their careers. So yeah, just an astonishing cricketer. Okay, well, that's going to be it, I think, for the World Cricket Show this time. Have you enjoyed this one, Tone?
It's good to be back. It is good to be back.
Here's a question. Is it good to be back?
It's good to be back. When are we going to do it again? That's the other question.
Well, this is a good question. So are you away now?
No, I'm not away for ages now.
I mean, no, not next week. And then I'm away. So it's going to be probably 3 weeks, I'd say.
Okay.
I've got to go to France to see Elena's family. There's just a lot on. I've been working, Tone, as you know.
Good. Get yourself... Stop lying in. Set that alarm for 4:30. Get those flagged emails clear and prioritise.
Yeah.
Get this to the top of the list. Well, I think definitely as we reach sort of spring, summer, I'm quite looking forward. I think we need to double down on our beach.
Yeah.
Visits, because it's a simple formula. It's do the pod, go for a swim.
It makes it much, it does make it more appealing.
It sweetens the deal a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the weather's been so nice in the last week that I'm like, well, it's summer now, but it's freezing tonight. It's meant to be bloody snowing on Thursday, isn't it? So it may be some time yet before we're back on the beach, but soon. Well, there's no test cricket now till June, is there? But there's IPL going on, Tone. I'm sure we'll have a lot to say about that. Maybe we can encourage listeners to send in some questions for us. Maybe we can do a listener question special in a few weeks' time. How about that? What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, keen.
Well, until then, if you enjoy the World Cricket Show, do get involved on social media. We're on all your major platforms, or send us an email, worldcricketshow@gmail.com. And, you know, rating and review on your podcast app is much appreciated too. But that's it. I think, Tone, is that it?
Yep.
We've done it all.
Hip, stop.
Covered it all. All right, we'll stay in school, everyone. And we will talk to you soon.
Yeah, cheers all.
Bye-bye for now.
Three. Smell your fear.